Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here once a week to talk about food, farming, recipes, advice.
And whatever we want to talk
about. Oh, and we've got some opinions on things, too. We'll just let you know. We'll let you know. This is community radio. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Yes, the Donalana Kitchen Show is supported by Farm to Folk, an Ames-based food cooperative supporting farmers and bringing local farm produce and meats to you all year round. Information on CSA shares and a la carte buying options are available at www.farmtofolk.com.
There it is. Yes, as I mentioned, this is community radio. Lots of things can happen. We're mostly all volunteers here, and we talk about what we want to talk about, which is kind of a real fun thing to be able to do. And we, So this Donalana Kitchen Show has been going on for quite a few years here now.
More than 3 years, Lana.
Oh, can you imagine that? When we got together, I thought, now what in the world can Don and I talk about? But we always find
something. We never run out, right?
We never run out. Heaven knows. Just put a little cup of coffee in front of us at around the noontime table here, and we just go on and on. This is March, and March is kind of trembling in like a lion. We have amazing weather. It is very cold today.
No, it's only moderately cold.
Moderately cold.
Yes.
All right. But we were discussing robins, and robins are very cold.
I have a huge flock of fat robins in my yard looking for anything they can find to eat.
Well, it's just something else. It's just something else. It's like one of these immigrant populations coming in.
Yes, I felt really sorry for them. Like, the women should have little shawls on their heads and, you know, they're carrying their bags with them.
Yeah, they want to move in.
We got to take care of them.
And we like them and we welcome them, too.
That's right. We welcome all of our immigrants, no matter what species they are.
Speaking of whatever species, oh, dear. This is March, and we're kind of moving on to the middle of March. St. Patrick's Day is coming up. Speaking of immigrants, and we're all immigrants here. And there was a bunch of folks that came over from Ireland, and they affected our nation in many, many ways. And this time of year, we think about St. Patrick's Day. Donna has a great cookbook to share about Ireland and food and things like that. And today, we welcome into our studio to talk about Ireland and other things, Mary Swander. Welcome to our kitchen table, Mary Swander.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, so Mary's the Poet Laureate of Iowa. She's also the Iowa ambassador to, unofficial, of course, the cultural ambassador to Ireland, and she is of Irish descent quite clearly. So she's going to tell us all things Irish, and she's going to start by telling us about St. Patrick.
St. Patrick was a monk from England.
Catholic monk, right?
Yeah, from England, and Ireland was, you know.
Oh, those pagans, right?
All those pagans, and so they needed to be converted, of course. And so St. Patrick had a really interesting early history. He had actually been a slave and captured and all sorts of cool things. And so he came to Ireland, and wasn't the only one, but he was kind of the key person that converted the Irish to Catholicism. And the Irish were, you know, always kind of had this pagan mentality. And so they were like,
they're Celts.
Yeah. So they were like, you know, they worshiped nature. And so they worshiped the rock over here and the sun and they worshiped the wind. And so it was like, oh.
And the goddesses and the gods.
Yeah. And so they're like, Jesus Christ. Okay. So they, there's just a layer. As Catholics were good at doing, they layered Catholicism on top of the pagan religion. So if you go there, the pagan religion is very much the underpinnings of the whole thing. And then they established monasteries, you know, all over the country. And their work was to transcribe, copy
manuscripts,
literature,
right?
Manuscripts.
This was before the printing press.
Yeah. And the Irish were such great storytellers that they came, the story is they came toward the religion because the monks taught them to read and write. And they wanted to record their story. They didn't really, you know, whatever the trappings were. Okay, okay. But they really wanted
to. We'll tell your story too, right?
and so, you know, that's what was the big boost to their great literature tradition.
They were looking for a publisher.
And yeah, wasn't that during the very, very dark ages in Europe when almost everything, all learning came to a standstill? And so in the outer reaches of the Celts kind of held down the fort with reading and writing and made those manuscripts.
That's correct.
Kept it going. Some beautiful manuscripts.
Yeah, no, just gorgeous. And, you know, the Book of Kells is one of them, and that's in now in Dublin. That's a must-see if you're going to Ireland for the first time or just doing the highlights of it. That's one of those old ancient manuscripts.
Good. So tell us about your connection to Ireland.
Well, my mother's family is 100% Irish, and they came to this country in two different waves. One, famine Irish. My great-grandmother was born into the famine in 1845. Not a good year to be born in Ireland. And then, so they came, and then my grandfather came during the tumultuous, like, 1917 era.
And your grandfather was a doctor,
yeah,
right?
He was a doctor.
So we came to rural Iowa, an Irish Catholic doctor.
Yep, and it wasn't easy because things were so divided up into ethnicities in those days, and there's so many prejudices that he could only have an Irish Catholic clientele. And so he had to – they basically –
What, we had so many doctors you had to – you could pick and choose by the doctor's religion?
No, we didn't have that many doctors. But Protestants were forbidden to go to him for his services. And so – yeah. And so they – my grandparents actually chased around from town to town in southern Iowa because the Ku Klux Klan was after him, burned a cross on their yard, burned my grandfather out of his office. So it was there was some high drama there, and then they.
I hate to say it, but my German ancestors in Illinois had
something to do with that.
But we're all good friends now.
Yeah, that's right. So it wasn't easy, and at the same time, he left Ireland. During that era, and the Black and Tans, which was a kind of a guerrilla group that the British organized, were after them there, and they were doing similar, maybe even worse things to my family on that. They were on the west coast of Ireland, and then before that, we had various famines and British colonialism, and we had. I actually went back. I've been going back for years, but I discovered our family farm.
Mary's one of the few immigrants in, the third generation or so that still knows her family in Ireland, knows the family history, has been to the family farm many, many times. I hope we're writing about this still.
We are. Yeah.
But we forgot to say Mary's a writer. Hello.
Yeah. And one of the things The family farm is right on the Atlantic Ocean, right on the ocean, on the west coast of Ireland in what's known as Connemara, which I had a archaeologist take me through the area at one time, and he said, okay, so here you are in your family farm, and this would be about the worst soil in...
On the planet?
On the Cleggan Peninsula here. And he said, and then the Cleggan Peninsula and the Argus Peninsula, that'd be about the worst soil in Connemara, which has the worst soil in all of Ireland. So that's kind of where we are. So...
So, of course, they wanted to come to Iowa.
When I stood there on that farm and looked out into the ocean, it's most beautiful, beautiful sight, but... for generations, they had families of 10 and 12 people living there on 80 acres, and there's maybe 10, 15 tillable. And tillable, that is not even a word to use there. The soil that is there is just rock. The soil that is there is decomposted seaweed that they haul up out of the...
So they haul this. This is true on a lot of those Atlantic coastal areas.
Right. Yep.
They haul up the seaweed.
Yep. And then they spread it over the rocks and let it decompose. And then, there wasn't a whole heck of a lot that would grow in there but potatoes. And then they had to farm in just kind of, to my view, kind of convoluted ways, contrary ways. It was hilly and rocky, for example. And they had to farm the potatoes in these big ridges.
The soil wasn't deep enough?
Yeah, well, no, right.
It so wasn't
exactly. It wasn't deep enough. And then it would, if you planted into that seaweed compost, it would just rot. There was no drainage. And then, on the farm, there's a hill, and they were going, you can still see the original potato ridge.
So how high is a potato ridge? Like 18 inches, 24 inches?
Yeah, about 24 inches. And you could see it going straight up the hill, and I thought, well, that's just weird because we would contour it around on a hill. And they were like, yeah, contour it around, right, Mary? And then it would just all pack down and hold the water in, and that's not what you want.
Because it's no soil it just, to go down.
Right.
Into,
it would just bog down and become literally become a bog. So farming there is really difficult. I mean, one of the most moving conversations I had, I found this first cousin of my mother's, and she knew all the connections and all the relatives and who's married to whom and da 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 da. And she drew it all out for me.
So begot so and so.
Yeah, no, it was really great. And she drew it all out for me on a notebook. And then she said, "But we all lived out on that peninsula, but your family was really rich." And I was like, "No, I don't think so." And she said, "Oh, they were really wealthy." And I said, "No, not. I know this story pretty well, and they were not wealthy." She said, "Oh, they were. They had shoes." And that stopped me.
And she
said, and they had at least two meals a day, and they would bring us supper. And I'm like, okay, they were wealthy in those terms.
Well, I guess that's how your grandfather got to go to medical school.
No, he actually got to go to medical school. That's another story because I had an uncle who owned the pub. And
that's how they got their money. Okay,
yeah, that's right. And for a while, the pub did really pretty well. And four of the 10 children immigrated. And then there was another uncle that had a little bit of money. And they sent the two older boys, my grandfather to medical school, another to law school. And they got there, and then the pub went bust. And then they really had to immigrate. They went to Edinburgh first, and then they were just sunk. They didn't have any money.
Do they graze sheep on that?
Now they do. Now, I mean, that's about all you can do.
Besides potatoes, what did they have animals? They must have what?
Yeah, they lived on. I have a little diary entry of during the 1800s, what their diet was. And it was breakfast, like a fourth of a potato, lunch, dinner, the other fourth of the potato, and a little bit of piece of fish.
Oh, fish. Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
And then supper might be like a piece of bread, a little bit of butter, and some milk.
What were they making bread out of?
They said they were able to grow some grain. I can't remember what kind of grain it would be in that area, but they did grow some grain. And then, oddly enough, you'd think they'd all have rickets and everything. You'd think they'd all be really sickly. Well, they weren't. They thrived. They were actually really healthy. And
I suppose they could eat the seaweed too.
Seaweed was a big part of their diet. And they actually sent, there's an island, bunches of islands, clusters of islands off the coast there. And one of the islands that my family intermarried with is Inishbofin Island, which is the island of the white cow. So they have this whole mythology about the cow. Anyway, they just the government decided this would be the Brits, of course. They decided, those people must be just, you know, sickly and horrible over there on Inishbofin, and they're, you know, they're isolated, ignored, forgotten. The sea is very rough there, so it's not like you just, like, you know,
swim
back and forth. No. And so they sent a doctor over, and it was like in the 1880s, to write up a report about these wretched
people
on Inishbofin. And because they were in the business of, the Brits were in the business of bringing them off the islands. You can imagine how well that went over for these people that had lived there for, you know, centuries and centuries. So he was supposed to write up this report about these wretched, sickly people. And first he wrote up about their diet. Mutton, lamb, fish, dairy, seaweed. They had potatoes. And there would be like cabbage, a few other little vegetables. Mm-hmm. That was it. There was no heart disease. There was no cancer. There was no alcoholism.
There was no
mental illness, and nobody had any cavities.
Whoa!
On the entire island. So they were basically eating a diet that was, well, you know, their physiology had become accustomed to it, or they, you know, the diet fed their physiology. So they were, like, very, very healthy, so they left them. And now there are, like, 300 of them out there still. On the island.
So now, is that where you go once
Yeah,
a
I
year?
Go to Inishbofin every year and teach in an ecology seminar, which is the most wonderful thing. It's me and seven or eight scientists. So there's like a botanist and a geologist, an entomologist, an ecologist. And
who are you teaching?
Oh, that's what's most fun. We're teaching elementary school teachers. It's like a continuing education course for them. But let me tell you about their elementary school teachers. It's the creme de la creme in Ireland. It's harder to become a teacher than it is to become a doctor.
Oh, good and, for them.
Yep. And so, you know, I walk into this classroom and one of the first times I was there, I walked in this classroom and I'd brought in this little poem from a poet on another island near there, the Aran Islands. And I put it up on the board and I go, let's just take a look at this poem. And I read it out loud. And in unison, all 30 of them together recited back to me the poem in Irish. And they all knew it by heart.
Oh.
Yeah. And so they, you know, it's just such a...
So is there a lot of Gaelic speaking still?
Yeah, especially in that area.
Uh-huh.
But the teachers had to know. They have a certain facility with Irish because they teach it in school. Mm. And it's just amazing. And then, then that afternoon, I said, I can't remember what technique I was teaching, but I was like, okay, you see this device used in Joyce a lot, I said, for example. In Dublin.
That would be James Joyce.
James Joyce. And I said, you know, in his book, The Dubliners, and one of the teachers said, oh, right, like in The Dead on page 136. I mean, it's just amazing. And they're not all like language arts teachers, though there's a lot of science, mostly science-oriented because they're going to this ecology seminar. But that is so much fun. It's really... a fun, stimulant time. And then we have field trips and there's Irish dance lessons and Irish music at night. And the archaeologist gives a talk and I give a reading. It's a lot of fun.
So things going on in Ireland. And Mary Swander is there to talk about it. You're listening to KHOI FM 89.1. This is Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're celebrating Ireland and the reasons we all think of Ireland here on coming up on St. Patrick's Day. There's a good history and lots of things to learn. We're here in the kitchen with Mary Swander. That was a tune called Freeze Britches by William Coulter and Friends from a CD called The Crooked Road. Well, Mary, you've been telling us about your visits to Ireland.
Right.
You've learned lots of things there.
And you go regularly.
I do. I go every year, sometimes twice a year. And it's always interesting to make your reservations for the trip because you don't, you know, how you hear, you just call and I'd like to check in the 11th and check out the 12th. Or we don't even call. We just do it all online, right? So there that, you know, you could send an email, but like they check email maybe once every 6 months there. So you can come.
Oh, my kind of place. Hallelujah.
It could come and go. So I always call everybody. And
at least they have telephones, right?
Oh, big time. Everybody's got cell phone now. So they love those cell phones. And so last week I was calling to make all my reservations. And
now this is for your trip this
summer.
This
is my trip this summer.
Okay.
And, oh, Mary Lynch.
Lynch is her Irish maiden name.
Yeah. And they just put down Mary Lynch or whatever that other name is that doesn't make any sense to them at all. So so they go, oh, Mary Lynch, you're coming. And they said, oh, no. You know, and I give them the dates and they go, oh, no. How are you liking that new president of yours? And and I'm like, oh, well, he's causing some problems. Oh, now you got to give the man a chance. And I'm like, well, I'm trying. And they're like, oh, no. We just love him here. And I'm like, you do? And this is Philomena that's telling me this. And she says, oh, we do. And I was like, well, that's really odd because you really loved Barack Obama. Oh, we love him. But we love this man even more, I think. And I said, really, why? She said, oh, he's bringing us so much business. All the Yanks are coming over here. They don't want to stay in the States anymore. So that's what it's like setting up your trip. You have these conversations. She said, we're really having a good time with this American politics over here.
Oh, boy. Well, laughing all the way to the bank. What can you say?
That's right.
So, Mary, you were telling us about the architecture and how literally they build in a culture and have done for centuries, having no trees.
That's
it's a treeless landscape.
The west coast there of Ireland and Connemara, it's a treeless landscape.
Because there's no soil.
Basically there's no soil. I mean, they have hedgerows and things like that now, but it's pretty barren. And they also cut, you know, because they didn't have any trees, they didn't have anything to use for heating, so they cut the peat, which would be the bog, and they burn that up. But that's another reason they don't have any soil. So
they've
stripped off
carbon holding they have.
Yeah.
There.
So everything, you know, their housing's made, you know, right out of the landscape. So they have this intricate art of building with the native granite stone.
It's called dry stone.
Yeah, dry stone. It's really beautiful. So they make all their fences and their houses, and there's no mortar. They just pile up stones, and there's an incredible art to it. And then they wedge in smaller stones.
Chink it in.
Uh-huh. And then the roof was thatch, which would be like kind of
right. I'm trying to go. How do you build a roof with no beams?
Yeah, they don't have any beams, and so
now thatch
is kind of like a marsh weed.
Oh, reeds.
Reeds.
So they bind them into.
So they bind them up in these little bundles, and then they basically pile them up. It's hard to show on the radio. They peak them so the rain will wash off, and they kind of interlock them together, and then they tie each end down.
So the size of the house is limited to the height of the reeds,
right? They're small houses, and then they anchor the reeds to the stone on each side of the house.
So it doesn't blow away.
Right.
Little pig. It built the house out of it.
It really is like the Three Little Pigs house. And then they have a constant – it's cold, cool climate, so they have a constant fire in the fireplace, which dries out the reeds.
Oh, right, because it's damp. It's ocean damp. Damp, yeah.
And, you know, in the old days, they didn't even have chimneys. They just let it filter up through the reeds, the smoke. And that was really common. And
quite the ventilation system.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't know why they don't all die of
lung disease.
And anyway, that the fire would keep the reeds dry. And then that went on for centuries and centuries. And then during the famine, whole families would just die in one day. They didn't necessarily die of starvation. Their bodies were weakened, and a lot of them were wiped out by typhus. That was the big killer. And so you might have like a family of 8 or 10 all just boom, die in the house on the same day. And, you know, typhus is contagious, so nobody want to go near them. Anyway. And then the fire would go out. And then over a course of a few weeks, the reeds would start to absorb water and start to cave in. And when they finally caved in, they'd pull the stones over on top of the family dead in the house.
So the house just became the
grave. Burial.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can drive by the landscape and see one house after another still there, the ruins of them still there. It's amazing. Oof. The real cemetery is so cool. The real cemetery is St. Brendan's, which is 1,000 years old, on Omi Island.
And how do they bury them if they have no soil?
Well, I'll tell you that. All right. So Omi Island is one of the – I think it's the only place in Ireland where you're actually buried out to sea. So if you die on the mainland, as my family did, you're – in those days, you're put in a donkey cart and you had your mass at the church, but your funeral's timed – and it still is to this day – to the tides, to the rhythm of the tides.
Oh, because when the tide's out, there's a land bridge?
So when the tide's out, you – pull,
scurry
you can
out there
walk
with the donkey cart.
With the donkey cart across the strand to the cemetery. And, yeah, there's no soil. And so, like, my cousin died, about 2 years ago. So now they have a hearse. They took him out in the hearse. But they basically put the coffin on top of the ground, just kind of rest it there. They put the flowers on top of the coffin, and they put a big fishing net on top of that.
So it doesn't blow away.
It doesn't blow away.
Well, what are the coffins made out of?
Wood. And they gradually sink down into the sand. And that's the
Where
burial.
Where do they get the wood for the coffins?
Well, now they have. Now they in the famine, they had one coffin and with a trap door. And, no, I'm not kidding.
Well,
and
yeah.
So I found, you know, and they would take successive people out there and just, and so I found our family plot. It's only about as big as this table, you know. I called up my cousin. I said, Jerry, what's the deal here? I can only find like maybe two people. And he goes, oh, no, Mary, they're all down there. And I'm like, all of them? He goes, oh, yeah, they're all down there. And I go, like the great-grandparents? Oh, yeah, the great-grandparents,
so
they're there.
The sand is pulling them down and sinking it into the eternity of the ocean.
And I go, the great-grandparents, the grandparents, the uncles and aunts? Oh, yeah, Uncle John Joe, everybody's down there. And I said, what? How is that possible? And he said, oh, they're just all stacked up. And they basically put the coffin on top of the sand. They just sink down there. And I, Jerry, you know, because you never know when they're telling you a tall tale over there. You just really don't know. And I said, oh, Jerry, this can't be right. And they go, how do you know that? And he goes, I know, Mary. I'm the grave digger.
See?
Wow. Okay.
Yep. So a funeral is an event. And I'm sorry I missed this year. They had the event of Omi Island, which was the funeral of Pascal Whelan.
Pascal Whelan.
Yeah, who was the only inhabitant left on Omi Island.
Oh.
Which is, you know, the island where this cemetery is. And it's beautiful. It's an old sacred site. There's still cairn ruins from the pagan days. Mm-hmm. There's an 8th century monastery, the ruins of that there.
Sort of how big is Omi Island?
Omi Island might be as big as probably like downtown Ames.
square mile, maybe?
Yeah, probably about a square mile. It's about a square mile. And so, you know, they used to be a population of like 300 again over there, and gradually they moved away because they used up all their fuel. They used up, they cut up all their bog. So they had to bring peat over in these little boats, and the little boats are just canoes. And they had so many accidents and stuff that was hard.
What are the boats made out of?
The boats are made out of cows. And they're curex. It's cow skin.
The hide.
Yeah, and then the stays are the ribs. In the old days, they were the ribs.
Bones and cow skin.
Yeah, in the old days. Now they can get lumber, but yeah. And then they can put canvas on them. But the old ones were well made, like hollowed out cows, basically. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Pascal, who had been a stuntman in John Huston movies. John Huston made, you know,
a lot of movies in Ireland.
Yeah.
That's right.
So Pascal was the stuntman. He did all the falling off of cliffs and, you know, riding horses and everything. He's quite a tough guy. And he was the only inhabitant there. And he lived in this little caravan, this little trailer. And every time I'd go over there, I'd have to go and see Pascal. And he'd say, oh! If it isn't the poet laureate. And then Pascal would come over to the Sweeney's pub, which is just across the Strand, every night to have his Guinness. And you know,
in his little boat?
He would walk.
Oh, he'd have to come with the ties.
Yeah, he'd have to come with the ties. And then, you know, if he didn't time it right,
he wouldn't get home. Right?
People would see him walking across holding his Guinness up above his head, you know, with the water up to his waist. But every time I wanted to go over, this is how it works there. I'd have to call Sweeney's and say, can you tell me what time the tides might be going out today? Oh, we'll check. We'll call you back. And then about 15 minutes later, they'd call me back with the times. And this went on I've been doing this for years. And then last year I found out that when they were going to call me back, they would then call Pascal over on Omi, because he was keeping track of all that. Although I thought, I don't know, I'm not so sure. He's the one that I'd be calling.
Well, he must know what he's doing.
The tides with his Guinness up over his head. So anyway, it was, I had four or five people write to me and describe the funeral, which is in this little Our Lady Star of the Sea church that actually my family built. And
no, wait, Pascal would be a ripe old age by now.
Oh, yeah. And the church is like right on the edge of the sea. And in the treeless landscape, the church had these beautiful carved pews. And I asked once, I said, well, how did it, you know, where'd those pews come from? And
wooden pews. Yeah.
And they were made from wood that was picked up on the shore from shipwrecks and and so everything was used and scavenged,
saved and
saved
treasured,
and yeah.
Amazing. You got wonderful stories about the real Ireland. There's real people over there. This time of year, we think about St. Patrick's Day, and we try ourselves here in the Midwest to have a festival and. So many of us have never been to Ireland. Maybe we've never even talked to a Gaelic
speaking person. Yeah, you were a little Irish here.
We're Irish, not Irish. Thank you, Donna. That was very good. And it's our idea of what Ireland is has these, you know, little leprechauns and
shamrocks,
Yeah, it's kind of odd how we think of that. And it seems that I've spoken to musicians, and this time of year, everybody wants to sing along those good old traditional Irish music. But a lot of it was the product of Irish immigrants kind of redoing things. It's like kind of our idea of what the Wild West was like. And not quite the real thing, but our idea of it. You know?
The American Irish version.
So it's American Irish. And I know Danny Boy is a lovely tune, but this time of year it gets sung a little bit too much. I had the pleasure of meeting an Irish musician. He's from a duo called Four Shillings Short, and he's from Ireland. And he's a
historian, and he talked about what Ireland's really like. He sung in Gaelic. He loved the old tongue. And it took me a while to know how to spell his name. His name is Aod O'Agon-Tumon. And Aod is A-O-D-H. So that's his first name, Aod. Aod. He would talk about coming to America and singing in our version of Irish pubs, and especially around St. Patrick's Day, he would get a little blowback because he would be singing what he would think would be Irish music, and he would kind of get strange looks. They didn't want to hear the real story. They wanted to hear St. Patrick's Day. So here's his tune called You're Not Irish.
When first I came to the USA with my guitar in hand, I was told that I could get a job singing songs from Ireland. So I headed up to Boston, I was sure 'twould be all right. But the very first night I got on the stage, I was in for a big surprise. They said, you're not Irish, you can't be Irish, you don't know Danny Boy. Or Tooraloo-ra-loo-ra, or even Irish eyes. You've got a hell of a nerve to say you came from Ireland. So cut out all the nonsense and sing McNamara's band. Well, to tell the truth, I got quite a shock and I didn't know what to say. So I sang a song in Gaelic, I thought that might win the day. But they looked at me suspiciously and I didn't know what was wrong. When a voice called up from the back of the room, now sing a real Irish song. They said, you're not Irish, you can't be Irish, you don't know Danny Boy. Or Tooraloo-ra-loo-ra, or even Irish eyes. You've got the hell of a nerve to say you came from Ireland. So cut out all the nonsense and sing McNamara's band. So the very next day I was on my way to Chicago, I was bound. I was ready to give it another try, nor let it get me down. From the stage they looked quite friendly, but I'd hardly sung one word. When a voice called out from the back of the room, and what do you think I heard? They said, you're not Irish, you can't be Irish, you don't know Danny Boy. Or Tooraloo-ra-loo-ra, or even Irish eyes. You've got the hell of a nerve to say you came from Ireland. So cut out all the nonsense and sing McNamara's band. Now, I travel all round the country, and it's always been the same. From L.A. to Philadelphia, and from Washington to Maine. And sometimes now I wonder if it's a secret society. And it doesn't matter wherever I go, they'll be waiting there for me.
Sing, you're not Irish, you can't be Irish, you don't know Danny Boy. Or Tooraloo-ra-loo-ra, or even Irish eyes. You got a hell of a nerve to say you came from Ireland. So cut out all that nonsense and sing McNamara's band.
No, you're not Irish, you can't be Irish, you don't know Danny Boy. Or Tooraloo-ra-loo-ra, or even Irish eyes. You got a hell of a nerve to say you came from Ireland. So cut out all the nonsense and sing McNamara's band.
A little editorial comment there on St. Patrick's Day and America's version of Irish music. We all have a good time. Yes, we do. Another thing that is perhaps more American than Irish this time of year, heaven forbid, is green beer. I remember trying that way back in the college days, and I only did that once. So I hope that that's just one of those things that it comes and goes, and you only try it once. And really, there's so many other good things out there. Our engineer, Evan Taylor, is the go-to guy for advice. Evan, what are you going to be raising your glass with come this weekend?
Certainly not green beer. The concept just makes my stomach want to turn. Instead, I have a much better beer that's on my radar this St. Patrick's Day. The Fire Trucker Brewing Co. out in Ankeny, so only a scant, 40 miles away, give or take.
A little bit close. Right.
has an Irish-style cream ale called Ladder 317.
And, Irish-style cream ale.
Irish-style cream ale.
What does that mean?
Okay, so...
Is it light, dark? What?
It is actually very light. It's very smooth, has a very a sweet kind of first taste to it, very thick, nice mouthfeel, very creamy feeling on the tongue. I think I read that Fire Trucker's head brewer was setting out to make something as light as they could in color, but as thick of a mouthfeel at the same time.
Do we have to go to Ankeny to taste this?
You do not. There are several bars around Ames that have it on tap. I know that DG's Tap House, for sure, is one of those. It's really delicious. I mean, they use a Maris Otter kind of golden malt as the beginning, as its base.
A Maris what?
Maris Otter. It's just a type of malt.
A malt. Okay.
A type of malt, yes. It's typically found in British and Irish ales, especially.
So all week long, we can maybe find this here in town, even.
Yeah, even a little bit after St. Patrick's Day, I
think.
I
want some right now.
I know, right? It's delicious. And I mean, of course, it's rounded out with East Kent Golding hops. So you have this very dry, very light bitterness at the very end. I would say it's probably more sweet than bitter. It only has about 32 IBU, so pretty low as far as bitterness scale goes. But really quite tasty. And I mean, just the...
And do we think it's really authentically Irish, or is this American Irish?
It's more of an American Irish. It's an American
Iowish.
Take on an Irish beer. Basically, what they're doing is they're brewing... they're brewing an American lager in the same way that you would an ale. So instead of, you're starting with your typical lager kind of grain bill, but instead of using a lager yeast, which is a bottom fermenting yeast, they use an ale yeast, which is top fermenting instead, and gives it slightly different, warmer characteristics.
And you promise it's not green. We should wear our green, not drink our
green.
Yes,
exactly.
Right?
Okay. Wear your green, don't drink your green. This is a very beautiful kind of pale golden beer. It's very, very attractive to the eyes.
Yum.
Sounds like a good thing to raise a glass. See, you ask Evan a question about beer, and you get an answer.
By golly,
you do.
The story.
So, you're listening to KHOI 89.1 FM. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Talking about Ireland today.
And just to, by the way, if you want to cook some Irish food to go along with your Irish beer, let me remind you that Darina Allen, that's D-A-R-I-N-A-A-L-L-E-N, is the Julia Child of Ireland. And she has many, many good cookbooks out, The Irish Traditional Cooking, Forgotten Skills of Cooking. Just grab a book and sit down and you will be transported. She's also, of course, a good storyteller in the book, as all Irish are. So if you want to immerse yourself in some Irish kinds of food, look for a Darina Allen book from the Ballymaloe Cooking School.
So, Mary, do you have anything to say about Irish food?
Well, is this the Supers and the Jumpers?
Oh, the Supers and the Jumpers. That's an interesting food story. Irish food was, as I've described, pretty basic until lately. Now it's great. I mean, it isn't the...
They have farmers markets there.
Oh, yeah. No, it's really, really nice. It isn't the cuisine of Italy or France or, anything.
But it has a lot of folk, basic, old-timey elements.
Really,
very
really, really wholesome, fresh fish, just beautiful stuff. So... The Supers and the Jumpers, this was in the right in sort of the post-famine era where the food was not so great and if there was anything at all. So in right there on the Argus Peninsula where my family was and on Omi Island, people were, you know, starving. It wasn't just the potato famine, you know, of 1845. There were periodic famines all through the whole colonialization period. So this is when this one was, I think it was in it was a little bit later, 1890, I believe, in another famine. And the Brits, the Protestants, came over and set up like these missionary stations, and they were trying to convert the Catholics, you know, once again, you know, the people went from paganism to Catholicism. Now they're supposed to go to Protestantism. And there was a schoolmaster on Omi Island who was Louis MacNeice, the famous poet Louis MacNeice's grandfather. Mm. And he was definitely a Protestant, and he was trying to convert the kids, the school kids. And if you converted, they gave you a bowl of soup, which is a huge thing.
Well, if you're hungry, yeah.
If you're starving to death, this was
absolutely
a huge thing.
Well, right. It's into plan.
And so they called them the supers and the jumpers because they would jump religions for this bowl of soup. And there were huge, huge tensions among the traditional Catholics and the jumpers or the supers because they had, like, gone over, jumped over to the other side. So, anyway, this MacNeice was converting all the little school kids on Omi Island.
The little hungry children.
Yeah. And there was a priest, Father Radigan, who was just furious about this whole thing. And so he started a riot with the people there to go. It was basically a lynch mob to go and kill MacNeice. And they, you know, came after him a couple times. And then he finally... big mob appeared, and they were really going to do him in. And he and his family fled across the Strand and hid in our house, which was the Lynch's house. And just the act of our family, like, taking them in.
Yeah, yeah, what are you doing protecting these
Protestants,
right,
Mary? And everybody who hears the story said, oh, they must have been jumpers or supers. I'm like, no, they weren't. And they said, oh, they were in, like, grave danger then. And so they hit them up in the reeds, and they had these lofts up that would be our rafters. And they hit them up there, and the mob came in, pulled them out, and almost killed them. And so this has become known as the Clifton Incident. This is like a historical event that happened. Yeah, and it's all wound into literary history of Louis MacNeice. And so my grandfather was in the house then when the Clifton Incident happened. And I love, you know, they just love me in Ireland because it's like, oh, Mary's family was in Clifton, and they were the Lynches in the Clifton Incident. And I say, well, yeah, if things had gone badly, more badly than they did that day, the world would be without two famous poets. Yeah,
there,
so there we are.
So. The Mary Lynch Swander poet.
Right, and Louis MacNeice. Yeah.
And so I don't get it. Why didn't the Catholics just bring the soup for the children?
They didn't have any soup. They didn't have any money. They didn't have any food.
Where was Rome? They should have sent some money. What's the matter with the Pope? Oh, boy, oh, boy.
See, international politics, even back then,
oh, yeah,
we think we've got it rough now. This is amazing.
Oh, yeah. No,
amazing.
These people would be sort of like our Appalachia. Just let mm-hmm. them die and rot, and mm-hmm. who cares? Yeah,
well,
I mean, that was the attitude.
A lot of Irish did move.
To Appalachia.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's why we have Appalachian music. It sounds awfully Irish to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once again, immigrants.
No, that's exactly.
Let's celebrate. So, Mary, thank you for sharing your wonderful Irish tales. And what's up for you this spring? What's going on in your life?
I have in your Iowa Poet Laureate.
Yeah, I have a couple events coming up. Next week, I believe it is March 23rd, I'm going to be at Buena Vista College and I'm in Storm Lake. And I'm going to keynote a conference on food insecurity.
Good idea.
We have
food insecurity.
So starting from the famine. And then mm-hmm. I'm going to highlight some of the interesting initiatives that have been done with ethnic groups around the state to address mm-hmm. food insecurity, like the Red Earth Farm at the Meskwaki settlement.
Yeah, we don't need to have the Protestants come in and feed our children. We can all feed our children.
No, exactly. And, you know, it's, you know, I'm writing out of that response. And then mm-hmm. the Hmong in Des Moines, who are our original urban gardeners, farmers, and then I've been working with the Sudanese in Iowa City who have are going to take over the old Johnson County Poor Farm. And
you're going to have to come back and just tell us about that story.
Yeah. And so there's some really interesting things happening. We can get pretty freaked out and depressed about food insecurity, but there are initiatives that are happening all around the state and around the country.
And Iowa has a long history of mm-hmm. taking care of refugees.
That's right. That's right. And you know, the Hmong and the Sudanese, they have refugee stories that are curl your hair. They're really, really intense. And they've both, you know, the Hmong have been here longer, but they've landed on their feet. And now, you know, they worked really hard. You know, they threw them all into the meatpacking plant. And now they're trying to find ways to return to farming. So then on March 26th at the church, the English River Church of the Brethren will be.
And where is that?
This is in South English, Iowa.
South English, Iowa.
Yeah. We'll be performing my play Vang, which is about immigrant farmers.
In Iowa.
It's 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon.
And say that date again?
It's March 26th at 2 p.m. Everybody's welcome at the English River Church of the Brethren, right outside of South English. And the interesting thing I found with them when they contacted me, they said, well, we're just flooded with immigrants here. And mm-hmm. I said, in South English? I said, well, tell me about that. And Ukrainians come in on visiting visas and work in the CAFOs all around there. They said, we have a sizable Ukrainian community. And they go, we really like these guys.
Yeah, I wonder what those Ukrainians are eating. That'll be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is amazing.
Yeah.
So you have stories to tell?
You must have a website where all this is listed.
Oh, yes. This is just www.maryswander.com. And all these events are listed there and the dates and the times. Maryswander.com will get you there.
That's Mary Swander, our Iowa Poet Laureate.
Thank you for being on the Donna Lana Kitchen today. We'll go out with some more Irish music here. This is Brodra Listin Varna. And you've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Find out more at khoifm.org. We have a Donna Lana Kitchen webpage there, too. Thanks to Mary. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had fine engineering and good beer advice from Evan Taylor.
Get yourself some Irish beer this week.
That's a good idea.
Or some Irish food. Have that corned beef. Come on.
Yeah. Have a bowl of soup. Eat good food and enjoy life.